This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Vanity Fair.
Hi, everybody. It's Katie Rich. Thank you, as always, so much for your continued support of Vanity Fair's Little Gold Men. We are so grateful to hear from you, to make the show for you. We hope that you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoy creating it. We're taking a break for the holidays, but we will be back next year to discuss the race to award season. The Golden Globes really are right around the corner. And in the meantime, we have an episode of Critics at Large from our friends at The New Yorker. In this episode, you can join Vincent Cunningham, Nomi Fry, and Alexandra Schwartz as they discuss how the legendary Martin Scorsese weaves together stories of American life and his newest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. Make sure to listen and follow The New Yorker's Critics at Large wherever you get your podcasts. Happy New Year!
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Just so we can know who's keeping an eye on us, I just brought a little. I brought a little paper doll of Scorsese that I made.
No. Yeah, well, you made? It's,
that makes it sound a lot more impressive than it is. But you know, I just happened to see that the Instagram account Director Fitz,
I was gonna have.
Had shown a very fetching image of Marty stepping out of a car, kind of windswept in a raincoat, and I thought this is the energy I would like to bring today.
Oh,
there it is.
He's
no, you can see it now.
A great trench coat.
Oh, yes, I can see. Yeah, now I can see.
Where is the studio that you're at, Nomi?
I'm on the coast.
You're in LA.
I was here to officiate my friend Chris's wedding. I am still recovering from that wedding 2 days hence. So I will try to do my best today to bring my most salient thoughts about the darkness that lies in the heart of America.
Kick us off. Let's do it.
Kicking us off. Okay, welcome to Critics at Large, everyone. A new podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham.
And I'm Alex Schwartz. We are all staff writers at The New Yorker, and each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. Okay, team, pod. When you think of the hallmarks of a film by Martin Scorsese, what do you think of?
I think of you know, this is a very obvious response. I think of beatdowns. I think of a lot of violence.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Very fair.
Yeah.
For me, the classic Scorsese experience is there's always a moment when I laugh and I really wish I hadn't laughed.
Yeah, exactly.
Uncomfortable laugh.
Yes.
Oh, that's really
dark
good.
Humor mixed with dark doings.
Yes.
When I think of Scorsese, I think of the ways his movies get at those darker aspects of human nature, violence, evil, corruption, the kind of mix of all three. You know, and of course, there are the classic mob movies that do this, movies like Mean Streets or Goodfellas, The Departed, The Irishman. And his new film does this too, but in a very different setting.
The Osage, they have the worst land possible. But they outsmarted everybody.
The land had oil on it. Black gold.
Killers of the Flower Moon is a historical epic that tracks a series of murders of native Osage people that took place in 1920s Oklahoma.
Their time is over.
It's just going to be another tragedy.
When this money started coming, we should have known it came with something else.
And it just opened this past weekend, and we have, I would say, a ton to talk about. I know I have a ton to talk about.
Absolutely.
And we're also going to call up David Gran, who is our illustrious colleague, a fellow staff writer at The New Yorker, who wrote the book that the film is based on and helped on the film, I think, as a kind of historical consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, and then I want to get to one big question I have today, which is about ownership, which is such a major thematic question in the movie and also occurs to me as a question to ask around the telling of the story that's in the movie. You know, specifically this question of who a story belongs to, who has the right to tell it. Scorsese's film focuses on the white perpetrators of violence against the Osage. Is this at the expense of the Osage's version of the story? We will discuss.
Can't wait.
Absolutely.
So can someone just give me a synopsis of the movie? Let's just get our all our ducks in a row. Vincent.
Yes. I'll say so.
I'm calling on you.
I
didn't see your hand raised, but I'm calling on you.
Thank you. The movie opens in 1920s Oklahoma, and we're dropped into Osage country. And because of the oil on Osage land, the Osage have become incredibly rich. They're the most wealthy people per capita in the world. And then there's also, right, this white society that exists among them.
Yeah, they're a sort of parasite class.
That's
in a
exactly
way.
Right. Yeah. Exactly right. And the main way that this white class can access the wealth of the Osage is by marrying into their families and inheriting their oil money. These what they call head rights couldn't be bought; they had to be inherited. So we meet this guy, played by Leo DiCaprio, named Ernest Burkhart, who has come to the Osage territory to live with his uncle, William Hale. And
King Hale.
King.
As he likes to call himself.
You could call me King.
You can call me King.
Yeah.
As he says to his nephew. Mm-hmm.
As he says to his nephew. Yeah. It's psychotically played by Robert De Niro. Mm. And Ernest is like a sort of everyman. He, I think, from the beginning portrayed as like sort of doltish and dense and not very perceptive to what's going on around him.
I would even cut the sort of.
Yes, he's a stupid guy.
Yeah, he's not sharp. Mm-hmm.
And very soon we see him marry a Native woman named Molly, mm-hmm. And as part of a big plan to sort of systematically kill her family and then possibly her, in an attempt to take control of these head rights.
That oil which should go to her sister as your wife. Well, he's taking money that by rights should go to Molly. The mother, Lizzie.
He's not in good shape.
She won't last. Most Osage don't live past 50. With these women dying, with how Osage suffered from illness, you have to make it the head rights come to you. You see?
So it's the slow, sort of compoundingly terrifying story of this very clear case of extraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, one thing that I think is worth saying right at the start is a little bit about the history of the Osage people and how they came into this position, which is recounted, I think, pretty wonderfully in the movie in a scene where Ernest Burkhart is reading from a history book of the Osage because his uncle has essentially told him, ingratiate yourself with them. Try mm-hmm. to get in as much as you can.
Right.
You know, here are their ways. Here are their customs. You try to learn it. Speak their language if you can. Get in. And he's reading this book about the Osage, and it explains that they had, you know, had to leave their territory, which when they got to this portion of Oklahoma, what did they discover? Oil. So they kind of luck in to this extraordinary wealth, and their recompense is being picked off one by one, as you say, Vincent, by the whites who, or as Naomi says, by the vulture class, an expression
right.
I think is totally apt in this case.
Yeah, I might have said parasite class, but they are also vultures.
Parasite class, yes. Can we just go on the most basic level here? Can I just... Did you guys – I don't even know yet. Did you like the movie?
I liked it, yes. I did. I'm pausing a little bit because for me, I have to say, just on the basic level of like taste and preference, my love of Scorsese as a kind of like master of excitement, you know, master of like – whirling limbs and kind of like short sharp cuts and you know and the things that maybe characterized earlier movies of his, like say Goodfellas, for instance. I struggle with myself with that shift because I love the earlier movies so much.
Okay, so I'm getting an on the fence, a diplomatic on the fence.
No,
feeling.
It's not diplomatic. I liked it. I think it's really good. It's visually stunning. It's intricate. The acting is incredible. It's the pacing is absolutely sure. You know, it's like it's an incredibly mature, impressive piece of work. So I'm not on the fence on that.
Mm-hmm.
I am on the fence about like the sort of visceral excitement it makes me feel is what I would say.
Vincent?
I think it's a masterpiece. Mm. It's like for me, the Scorsese movies of the last 20 years, let's say, it's right there with Wolf of Wall Street, which I also love. And they operate in very different registers. I think like Wolf of Wall Street indulges in the velocity that Nomi's talking about. It has some of that sort of gleeful, in-your-face, fun Scorsese. Whereas Killers is, it's not slow because it's so dense with incident, but it has this elegiac.
Elegiac, yeah.
In some ways, it is a eulogy for something. And but it does have all these, you know, varied moments of outlays of information. You mentioned that great scene where he's turning the pages of the book, Leo is, or Ernest is, and we're getting this information in a voiceover. Before that, we have a voiceover with the voice that turns out to be Molly, Ernest's wife, in these sort of very still tableaus of unsolved murders. You know, a jarring early moment is a woman is killed. We see her being shot and her baby taken out of the stroller that she's been pushing. And even as the voiceover is saying, you know, this was claimed as a suicide, we see that it was a murder. And there's a lot of other times when people are laying in their deathbeds and being like, unsolved, unsolved. So these different like formal approaches to outlays of information. And of course, there's like a very big formal departure at the end, a coda that we will discuss. It seems to me like just someone with every single tool at his disposal. I think this might be a difference in our taste, Nomi. I am just so impressed. Late style, generally, when people start to like show a kind of formal mastery, these are usually my favorite works. So I left like, I don't know, like every hair on my body was standing up, and it's like I fucking loved it. How about you?
Oh, well,
Alex, give us the definitive answer so we know what to think.
Chills, my friends. Chills. Yeah, I feel pretty haunted by this film, I would say. The experience for me has actually grown in the few days since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of visions of the film itself recurring to me. And, you know, even the cry of Molly Burkhart, who is played so amazingly by Lily Gladstone, this kind of guttural grief that she has to experience not once, not twice, but many times during the course of this movie in which her sisters and mother and other friends and acquaintances are hunted down. That there's something so just bone deep about that kind of grief and that performance and the way that Scorsese gives it room to breathe. That has really stayed with me. In a minute, David Gran is going to come on and tell us about watching his reporting come to life in the hands of Scorsese.
Critics at Large from The New Yorker will be right back.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So, Scorsese has centered this movie around a very unusual love story between Molly and Ernest Burkhart. What did you guys make of the love story at the heart of this?
Well, in general, thematically, I think the idea that people's motives aren't always completely clear to themselves and that good intertwines with evil is one of the things that Scorsese is very good at. It reminded me of, I don't know, even in Casino, the classic Scorsese movie from 1995, there's a relationship between Ginger, played by Sharon Stone, and Ace, played by Robert De Niro, where he very much loves her and is obsessed with her. She's a kind of like Vegas sort of grifter, you know, but very charming.
Who didn't want Ginger? She was one of the best known, best liked, and most respected hustlers in town. Smart hustlers like her could keep a guy awake for 2 or 3 days before sending him home broke to the little woman and his bank examiners.
Meanwhile, she has this relationship with Lester, played by James Woods, and he is grifting Ginger. There's a series of relationships where love stands shoulder to shoulder with the most evil impulses possible. So for me, in a way, even though this is a very different kind of movie, as we've said, the relationship between Ernest and Molly seemed natural to me in the Scorsese universe.
The other thing going on here, of course, is the racialized nature of this relationship.
Yes, you know, absolutely. Which is different. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, totally different because there's such an unstable balance here between the love story between two people, between Ernest and Molly, and this kind of alliance love story that Ernest's uncle, King Hill, is trying to build between the parasitic whites and the Osage. Marriage as, I think we can say, kind of like a tool of war versus marriage between two individuals as a bond of love. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain kind of clear-eyed nature with which Molly, for instance, goes into the relationship. She understands that the whites are interested in the wealth that the Osage have. She says it explicitly, as does Ernest at the beginning. He says, "I love money." She knows that wealth is a big perk and, you know.
Yeah, she says Coyote loves money. She calls
him Coyote. Yes, she calls him Coyote, exactly. Yeah.
When she says that, she's speaking in the Osage language. She's speaking to these other women. And they're looking up at him. He's kind of rooting on some race that's happening, but also looking back at her. And she's like, "Coyote, you know, yeah, this Coyote guy, he wants money, but blah, blah, blah." And you can see her, she's like grinning at him. You can see her kind of falling in love almost against her own will, against like the very high intelligence that she clearly has. Yeah. Whereas Ernest seems to me like a totally allegorical American, someone who is offered lots of things that sound easy and is able to block off what he eventually will have to do to get them.
That's so smart. Yeah.
But nonetheless, even within this really poisoned framework, some kind of bond is established between the two of them. And I think the beauty of the movie is that I at least really believed it, even as it becomes more and more difficult for Ernest to lie to himself about what he's doing and how it affects Molly, the person, you know, in this most human level. So we are now about to be joined by David Gran, who's a fellow staff writer at The New Yorker and who wrote the book that Killers of the Flower Moon is based on. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hey, everybody.
We're just chatting about love.
Twisted love, I guess.
Twisted love.
Sick love? I don't know, man.
We're so thrilled that you're here to talk with us.
Can I ask, David, how did the story first come to you? And what was the moment for you when you were like, okay, this is going to be a book. This is big. This is what I'm meant to do for the next 5 years or
however
long it took. Yeah.
It's always good when you begin a book that you never think it will take 5 years. And then, because I think if you did, you might never embark, but you always think, oh, I could do this quickly. But,
cut to 5 years later.
Exactly. Yeah, and your banging hair your head gone, against the wall. And you're gray and you're walking with a cane. But, you know, I had heard about this from a historian. And I decided to make a trip out to the Osage Nation. And at that time, I thought, well, maybe an article might come out of this. And I made a trip to the Osage Nation Museum, which is kind of the first, what was the first thing you do when you go to a place? Well, they had a museum, so I thought I would go there. Yeah. And I described this in this book, but there was this great panoramic photograph on the wall, which was taken, now my memory, I can't remember, it was 1923 or 1924. But it showed members of the Osage Nation along with white settlers. Right. And I'm looking at it, just kind of admiring this incredible photograph. And I noticed that a portion of the photograph was missing. And I asked the then museum director, and I said, you know, why is part of the photograph missing? And she said it had contained this figure so frightening she had decided to remove it. And she then pointed to that missing panel and she said, the devil was standing right there.
Mm. Wow.
And then she went down into the basement. And she brought up an image of the missing pen. It was just small, but she had an image of it. And there I could see peering out very creepily from the corner. She pointed to one of the main killers of many of the Osage, a very flamboyant, a brutal killer. And I was just so haunted by that. And it was really that rare moment where a book had a real origin story.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, in that instant I knew this is a story I need to tell. And so I began the project. And the real question was not whether I wanted to write the book, but just whether I could. You know, could I find the underlying records? Could I find the oral histories? Because I really wanted this story to not be just a recitation of names and dates and when you died. I wanted it to be Molly Burkhart. I wanted you to know who she was as best I could, that these were people with souls and lives and mischievous sense of humor or whatever it might have been, so that we could know them.
Yeah. I mean, I do think you do a wonderful job of filling up these people who are, of course, you know, only as records and, you know, kind of from histories and so on. But, you know, one of the challenges for a writer bound by historical fact is then how to make these characters real, but still stick to the truth, obviously, and not just make up, you know. Tell us your advice for that, for any aspiring, you know, sort of like historical journalist and researcher. Tell us your secrets. How does one do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very time consuming, which I think is the ultimate secret, because, you know, if you're not witnessing things, you really have to reconstruct them. And I would go out to Osage County and I would live there for, you know, a couple months a year and just do meet people. And the Osage elders in particular, you know, I would interview one and they would share with me their story. And then they say, well, you know, you really need to meet Mary Jo Webb. And so they would take me over to see Mary Jo Webb. And so it was just that process of immersion. But it also really changed the shape of the story. Because when I began researching my book, I really thought of it the way the FBI, which came in to investigate it, had thought of the case, or at least the way they had represented it. They had said, you know, this was kind of this singular evil figure who committed this crime, and he had done it with a couple of henchmen, that the Bureau had caught them, and that ended the Osage reign of terror. But I kept meeting these Osage elders, and they would tell me, you know, there was another suspicious death in my family that was never actually investigated. Mm. I remember Mary Jo Webb. I'll never forget this. You know, she's since passed, but I remember her. I was in her house in Fairfax where many of these crimes took place, including a bombing. And she went to her closet and she brought out this little cardboard box. And inside were all these documents. And I said, what are those? And she said, well, I spent decades trying to investigate the death of one of my ancestors to figure out who was the perpetrator. And she shared those with me. And so I began to think, wait a second, I think the story I'm looking at may be very different. There really was a much deeper and darker conspiracy that the Bureau never exposed.
Well,
so, I mean, you you do all of this amazing work. You figure this out. You put out a book. It's a great success. Is the next thing that Martin Scorsese calls you and says, hey, David, I'd like to make a picture? Like, what? How does this all happen where you suddenly know Martin Scorsese and he's making a movie based on your book?
Yeah.
And how did it feel?
Yeah, were you as surprised as I was that it was Martin Scorsese?
Yes. Look, I'm an ink stain wretch. I have spent my whole life as an ink stain wretch. I live and work out of little closets with boxes of documents. But like everybody else, I'm a total film buff. I just grew up watching Taxi Driver and Goodfellas and Casino and Mean Streets. And so, to be honest, you're both incredibly excited. But if I'm being a little bit honest, you're a little bit terrified because you're like, okay,
what's it going to do to my thing?
Yeah, well, and to be honest, less my thing than just you have developed relationships with Osage Nation who have entrusted you with these stories. And you've tried to record them as best you can. And you feel like hopefully you have earned the trust and kept that trust. And so I knew I was in the best filmmaking hands ever. I mean, I never worried that it would be a remarkable film with incredible shots and acting, like, but that they would get the history and want to get at these deeper truths and get at the sense of complicity and get at what really underlay these crimes. But I will say that the second I spoke to Scorsese and then began to speak to his people, they shared that commitment. And so I felt good. And then the other thing was, most of my interactions with them were kind of the way you would have interactions with an editor. I mean, they were like, oh, okay, what can we know? What can we learn? There was just kind of this voracious curiosity where I was just kind of sending them documents, or an actor might call and be like, you know, what do you know about this, the real person I'm going to play?
So would Leo call you up?
He would.
Hey, Dave.
We want to know. We want to know about Leo.
Yeah, we just want, come on, give
We're
us some juice.
We're only human.
Or Bobby. Did Bobby call?
No, Bobby never Bobby called come me calling? Up. Bobby never called me up. But DiCaprio would call me. And I'll say this about DiCaprio. I think he was trying to get at, that relationship too. You know, I think they all were trying to figure out this relationship with Molly and to try to understand it. And I remember once, and this was toward the end of a conversation with him, where I suddenly watched him suddenly slipping into the character and even using
in person
voice.
Or
on the phone.
On the phone. Phone.
Yeah. And I just.
Did he do it like to show?
He was figuring it out. And I just, I didn't say anything to him. I just was like, but I got off the phone. I was like, that was incredible.
Have you heard from any of your Osage friends or sources about their reactions to the movie? I'm so curious to hear.
Yeah, you know, of course. And you know, that was what you're most nervous about.
Yeah.
I think I never want to speak for other people. I'm really careful about that unless someone says directly. And even my sense is that you are going to get, you know, a breadth of reactions the way anyone seeing a movie would be. But in this case, seeing a movie about your history and not ancient history. I think that's something that's really important. Like, I went to a screening of this film, a private screening in Tulsa, which the movie people, to their credit, arranged to make sure that many Osage saw the film before it came out. So they wouldn't suddenly be seeing this film with everyone else. They would have time to process it. And, you know, in those screening rooms were people watching their grandfathers or grandmothers or great aunts being murdered. And interestingly enough, I've seen this screening elsewhere where people laugh because there is this kind of, you know, sometimes this kind of the bad people, you know,
banter. They kind of, right.
Yeah,
I mean, it is a Scorsese movie.
Yeah,
there's a little bit of the mobbish banter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like
Right. And when you watched it in that, I tell you, when I watched it in the Tulsa room, I never heard a word. There was not one laughter. It was just quiet. Overwhelmingly, amid the difficulties of processing and the emotion, I have only heard, for the most part, only very positive feelings. And the reason was that they were so involved in the film. And, you know, one of the first and most important decisions that was so important to them, and I think really ended up, it was in some ways the key decision, I think, was they wanted it filmed in Osage territory. They thought the filming should take place there. And we all know from movie business, that's pretty hard these days. I guess, you know, you would all know better than me, but I don't think it happens too often. You know, it's all, you're always filming where there's some tax credits. So you never, absolutely. You know, something takes place in Texas, but you shoot it in Ohio. Like, never.
In Toronto, The number of times I've seen Toronto stand in for New York City and or New York City stand in for Chicago or whatever it is.
Right,
Right.
Yeah. And I think that was such a key early decision because what it meant was that the production was going to be there and they were going to be there for months surrounded in the community. And I think that was so key because then they immersed themselves, built the relationships, heard all the stories, ended up really shaping the story they told. So many Osage are involved in every level of that production. I mean, I visited the set for several days and they were just, you know, extras, speaking roles, the language consultants, the costume designs. I mean, everything. It really was something, you know, it was remarkable.
David, you know, not to, we have to let you go in a second, but we must put you on the hot seat briefly. Leaving aside Killers of the Flower Moon,
yes.
Do you have a favorite Scorsese movie?
We know he's your friend now,
it's
but
unfair.
Just answer.
It's brutal.
Just answer.
It's really hard to choose.
It is really hard. I mean, Wolf of Wall Street is incredible. Goodfellas is always incredible. How can you not pick Taxi Driver?
I know.
You know, I think Silence is a beautiful, very powerful and evocative movie and evokes some of the stillness that is in Killers of the Flower Moon that has a real power.
All right, so we're going to put you down as five favorites, 5 to 6 favorites. We'll let you elegantly wriggle your way out of that one.
Yeah,
but
good.
Should you reappear, we will be asking you to narrow it down.
Say hi to Marty for us, please.
Yeah, please say hi to Marty for us.
And tell him we'd love to have him on.
Yeah, we'd love to have him on.
Well, thank you all. This was such
Come
a pleasure.
Come on the pod, Marty.
And congrats on the new
thanks
pod.
So much,
it's terrific.
Thanks so much, David.
Thank you so much, David.
All right, take care.
Thank you. Bye.
So what can or should a movie do to address the wrongs of the past? Critics at Large from The New Yorker will be back in a minute.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You know, guys, I thought it was so interesting what David Gran was just saying about the way that Scorsese incorporated the Osage community into the filmmaking process. Mm-hmm. One thing I know about Scorsese's filmmaking in general is that he wants the reality of the world to come in. Like, one of my favorite Scorsese scenes from Goodfellas is the famous Joe Pesci, Am I Funny scene.
You're really funny. Really funny.
What do you mean I'm funny?
It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk?
What? It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's funny, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Anthony. He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how?
You guys know what I'm talking about?
Funny like a clown?
Yeah, funny like a
funny
clown.
Funny like a clown? Funny how?
Like, that scene is so frightening and where something that seems to be really just everyone's laughing and suddenly the laughter is turned and it becomes super dark and scary. And actually, to my knowledge, it was something that had happened to Joe Pesci. He described it to Scorsese, and Scorsese said, yeah, okay, that should be in the movie. That's got to be in. So it's, you know, I think a lot of the Scorsese experience is about trying to, you know, as you were saying before, Nomi, the film is very produced. It's very beautiful. It really looks like a movie, but also trying to get reality in there.
Yes.
So one thing I wanted to ask you guys about, you know, one inevitable criticism of this movie, and I understand it, is going to be that it isn't Scorsese's film to make. This is, I've seen it already in some reviews, kind of what right does Scorsese have to look at this history? I mean, to my mind, at least, this is a film about whiteness just as much as it is a film about what happened to the Osage.
And, absolutely.
And you know, to that end, I think it's kind of essential that a filmmaker with the stature of someone like Martin Scorsese interrogates those questions about how evil is done and how racialized evil is done. But what do you guys think?
I totally agree with that. And, you know, one way we've, you know, you could think about this as an extension of Scorsese and organized crime, because, of course, this is an organized crime. But another way to think about this, which I think makes it new in the Scorsese verse, is it's a horror film and the white people are the monsters. Like every single time a Native person and a member of the Osage Nation, like, trusts a white person for any reason, as a doctor, as a friend, as a husband, as anything, I'm like, it's like a jump scare in this movie.
Totally.
Absolutely, right? The sort of the trauma of this experience, the particularity, the its rootedness in place, of course, belongs most intimately to the Osage people. But the proclivities that gave rise to it, the sort of sensibilities that survive in our culture today, is something that every person, I think, that has anything to do with the United States needs to engage with. One thing I thought about a lot is, you know, Scorsese has talked a lot about Catholicism and especially Jesuit spirituality, of course, across his movies, and it's something that, you know, is a big influence in his life. And I thinking about this as the Jesuits have a spiritual practice that's called the examination of conscience. It's a way to pray. At the end of the day, you look at everything you did that day, and when was I close to God and when was I not? This sort of accounting, you know? And it seems like this movie is that kind of searing examination. It's asking where in my culture was I close to the good, and where, you know, in our history were we very much not?
Yeah. You can't deal with history by refusing to deal with it. I mean, that sounds so stupid, but like, you can't, nothing is going to be gained from someone like Scorsese saying, this is not my story to tell. Okay. Like, we're not going to be able to deal with this and with the burden and guilt of whiteness by saying this story should only be told by the victims of the story. Part of a political act in filmmaking, in this case, is to acknowledge and admit that you're part of the problem and you need to examine this problem. And it can be, and perhaps even should be, your place to go back into these stories and say, this is what happened. And I'm looking at this in as clear-eyed a way as possible. And so and of course, alongside that, being also as honest and sensitive and involved as possible with the Osage Nation and, you know, and the people's actual stories.
Yeah, I think, you know, you said, Nomi, like that the phrase part of the problem. And I would say certainly, like, the way I would put it is inheritors of the problem, that it's a
yes.
problem that is all of ours to reckon with.
To reckon with, exactly.
And it has to be reckoned with anew, kind of, you know, in each generation. And also, as David Grant said, this is not long ago. This is quite right. recent. You know, also in the movie, of course, there is, I think, a very canny presentation of the Tulsa massacre, the Tulsa race riots that destroyed Black Wall Street, you know, where whites in Tulsa completely crushed the Black community. Scorsese is working this in. He's really looking at this and thinking about this.
Right.
And to that end, this is just to say that the coda of the film I found incredibly powerful. I actually actually cried a bit when Marty himself appeared on screen.
Mm.
There's
it
this,
was very moving.
I found it really moving. It's just to explain to people who haven't seen this film yet, who want to know what the exact last moments of it are like, so that you can have literally every piece of it spoiled before you go. you know, the coda
enhanced,
is
not spoiled.
Enhanced. Thank you. Yes. See how? Yes. Let me paint with words what what Martin Scorsese has painted for you with his whole box of tricks. Scorsese stages a radio play. I'm guessing that the time for it is 1940s. It could be 1930s.
Based on the action that happens that you're going to describe, it seems like the 40s.
Yeah, that's at least that's what I was thinking. And we're in a theater. They're recording a live radio show for an audience made up of, seems pretty much exclusively white people, unsurprisingly. about the Osage murders, and they're dramatizing it. They have Foley artists who are creating the sounds of shots going off or of a house burning down in an explosion. And at the end, Scorsese himself comes up to read the obituary of Molly Burkhart, the real obituary. And it's very simple obituary. It makes no mention of the murders. And I just found that moment so so emotional, quite honestly, because to me, I think what he's doing is he's showing the way that real life gets packaged into entertainment, in this case, definitely white entertainment for a white audience by white people. And he himself, you know, white Martin Scorsese, is there to sort of say, yeah, I'm aware of this and I know and I've tried to do it differently, but I'm also, this is who I am as well. Yeah. It's really actually quite multi-
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think it's very multi-layered.
Multi-layered.
As you say, and, you know, it's the sort of coda that wraps a lot of these questions into it by him kind of spelling onto us in a subtle but meaningful way some of the potential traps, potential and inevitable, probably, you know, of one person telling another person's story or another people's story, in this case, the Osage Nation, and trying to do it justice. You know, so of course, like in this radio play, right, that he is leading or that he's kind of capping, it's clear that a lot of things are missed. And this movie does something very different, and yet it's a movie. You know what I mean? Like a movie contains.
It's still an entertainment.
It's still an entertainment, and it's still
necessarily limited.
A movie isn't history. A movie isn't life. A movie can't bring anyone back. A movie can't. The wheels of justice, it might turn them, you know, a little bit, and refigure our understanding of the past. But the past is the past. You know. So I think there's both an attempt and an acknowledgement of the difficulty of the attempt, if that makes sense.
Is that how you read it, Vincent?
Yeah, it closed actually an emotional loop for me that was just – I couldn't tell if it was just me or, you know. There's an early scene. It's when Ernest, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, first meets William Hale, played by Robert De Niro. And they're sitting in this living room and De Niro's kind of telling him all – this is when he's – seducingly introducing him into this new landscape, right? For me, so strange. This happens to me sometimes in movies with, like, really big movie stars in them. For a minute, it just, like, I was so out of it. I was like, that's Leo DiCaprio. That's Robert De Niro. And they're doing voices. You know what I mean? It's like...
It's defamiliarization.
Like, it was almost like it was SNL or something. I was like, for a minute, I was like, come on. You know, it's like, but that happens to me a lot in movies. Just because, like, oh, it's a movie.
They're famous. They're super famous.
It's an entertainment, you know? And so I do think that it was like this, you know, this moment of, it was the movie in microcosm and this radio play. It's like, you know, at one point they make the noise of the cars of that period. It's like, oh, or whatever. And it's like, we've been hearing that sound all through this movie. Like, that too is a sound effect, you know? And then after talking to David, it also strikes me, it's like, you know, there's the immensity, the awful immensity and uncapturable nature of reality. And then someone like David makes a book. And then someone like Martin Scorsese makes a movie. And then here's this little radio play. It's like these processes by which, like, reality, which is uncapturable, is a sort of, like, strained through our processes of representation, however, whatever forms they take. History, even history is not reality. History, even,
yes.
Like, what we
yes.
think of history, capital H, is not the past.
It's a certain capturing of the
right?
past.
Yeah. And so this, like, the impossibility of the attempt, and it becomes, I think, a way of talking about a career. It's like, I did what I could.
That's so nice. I love that. Yeah.
I mean, Nomi, you say, and you're right, of course, and certainly literally, that this can bring no one back, but... You know, here I want to speak on behalf of the attempt because...
Oh, my God. The attempt is the most important thing in the world. Why are we doing a podcast where we talk about the making of culture? Culture is the attempt. The culture is the attempt.
You said it. Culture is the attempt. Like, the... It's like, it's true. It's true. It's true. You know, that's why I find that moment so multifaceted and multi-layered. Just Scorsese saying, you know, I've tried... I've failed, or have I? But I've given you something, and I've worked with what I could work with. And there is something so moving to me that this is, at 80 years old, this is what Scorsese wanted to do. He wanted to find a new frontier for himself.
Yeah.
And I think, like, with a certain ethical imperative to it, of the kind of story he wanted to tell and not just revert back to what he knows and has known. I'm just sitting with my feelings about it for a second, because I really did, tears just sprang to my eyes.
Yeah.
In the theater.
I totally get what you're saying. I didn't cry, but I did feel moved. And there's something just about his, like, you know, his Scorsese's just beautiful face that we've known now for so long, and we've known his work for so long. His dear face, and he's so important and has given us so much. And despite my absolutely, like, infantile tastes in, like, what I tend to like, which, as you know, we've already began sketching here over the last several weeks, is, you know, sort of blood and guts and sex and money and all of that.
Please, you're a closeted sophisticate, and everyone
I'm
needs
a
to know it.
Closeted, right. Like, give me Marty's 80-year-old face at the end of a 4-hour movie, and I'm like, oh, I love him. I love him.
Which is just to say that we're not done discussing you, Martin Scorsese.
Not even close.
We're not even close.
Never.
Buster. So we're gonna don't get any ideas about retiring or anything else, because Critics at Large is just getting started. This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby. Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music. We had engineering help today from Jake Loomis, and this episode was mixed by Mike Kutchman. If you enjoyed the episode, go ahead and leave us a review wherever you listen. We'd love to hear what you think. See you next time. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.